Master Computer is wrong. Softwares now could destroy us. I'm going to stop Holmes. By myself if I have to.
You won't have to do it by yourself.
Well, I was rather counting on your help, son.
I didn't mean me.
Thanks.
I'm going to.
I would like to help.
I know close-up magic.
Okay.
The shape of things to come.
Yeah. So, where to begin? Well, it was bad.
Yeah. This helps me feel better about my 9 on Jack Frost. Because yeah. Now I'm like, oh yeah, it does get a lot worse than that. So I feel like the calibration of my score is correct.
Yeah. It's interesting. After that last one, where I talked about Space Mutiny all the time, I feel like I want to talk about Space Mutiny again. I feel like this movie is basically Space Mutiny, except somehow someone managed to suck all the joy out of it.
Yeah, I don't know. There's like a thing about how bad movies can be really interesting and fun, or just really plodding and boring. And what's interesting about this compared to something like Space Mutiny is that they're very similar films, like with very similar budgets and similar plots. Like we talked a lot about how like the bad guys basically doing the same thing,
right,
in both films. And yet, why is this one so much more boring and uninteresting?
So I think one of the reasons, I made a mental note of, there's this one scene where the two young hotties end up on the spaceship because his dad is there. And they're like, you can't go alone. We're going to go with you. Mm-hmm. And that scene is really the two of them essentially committing to leaving everything they know and love to go off on this spaceship and almost certainly die. But they treat it with the same sincerity that you and I would have about like the fact that they're out of the $10 sandwich deal at Habit Burger Grill. I mean, There's like no gravitas.
Well, that's the acting, right?
Yeah.
I think the acting is the main culprit. Nobody in this movie was worth being on screen except maybe Jack Palance. And even Jack Palance, I've seen him in like, there's a fantasy movie where he's the bad guy and some kind of like underground fantasy. I remember there's another one they watch and he gets way more like juicy lines to chew on. Here he's pretty like middling, like he's pretty boring until the very end. And then suddenly he's like, you are my creations. And then he dies and it's like, oh, well, that was fun for a second.
So the acting is bad, no question, but I can't visualize what you could do with those lines. I think the script writing is also terrible.
Yeah,
because
it was bad.
Even if you were a good actor, what would you do with that scene? Like, you're on the spaceship, you realize your dad is going to launch. I mean, I don't remember what actual lines he has, but he only has like one or two lines. Somehow you'd have to cram everything about I'm leaving everything behind into those two lines. Even if you tried to like oversell them, it would just come across as really like you only have two choices: wooden, which is what they went with, or Overly melodramatic.
Yeah. And I wonder if maybe it was one of those things where the director of this was trying to make it really serious and really like realistic. And that's why they told them to like tone it down and be really like wooden, like you said.
Right.
Because they were trying to be like, you're a spaceship crew and you got to be real military serious about everything.
I wonder when this came out. Because there was this whole school of thought, like the Stanley Kubrick, HAL 2001, A Space Odyssey, like to under emote.
2001 was the 80s, right?
Yeah.
This has got to be before that, right?
Got to be.
This felt 70s or even... like early 70s, I think.
It did feel that way.
If I was going to pick a year, I'd say between like around 73 or something. Because of the robots, they were very 70s.
Right.
And the spaceship designs and the clothing.
Right.
You know, the outfits were very 70s.
Right.
Especially the bad guy. I mean, with the cape and the little cowl. And I mean, that was like classic 70s villain.
So how much of this, if we went and did some research later, what do you think we would find the actual story of H.G. Wells, The Shape of Things to Come?
You know, it's funny because I actually wonder if what happened here is that they randomly, occasionally threw things in from the book, and that might have actually made it more confusing than if they had just... Because, like, there were whole passages in this movie that didn't make any sense in conjunction with anything else. And the only possibilities are either they were padding the film because they just needed more time, or they were pulling scenes from the book to try and make it more like the book. Like that entire planet sequence in the middle. We got to talk about that because, like, they go down to a planet and I guess they need help from a guy.
You're talking about the one with the children where they're supposed to be repairing the ship.
They go in the station. They find him dead. Then there's these creatures. Then the creatures turn out to just be children. Then the children turn out to have radiation poisoning because of old weapons that are on the planet.
Right.
And then after all of that, and I think it probably goes on for like 20 minutes or something.
Yeah.
They just say, well, we got to go. But maybe we'll come back for you. But probably not.
Right.
Have fun, kids.
Right.
And they just leave. And they never reference it again.
Right.
And it's in the dead center of the film.
Right.
Which makes me think, like, that part must have been from the book, and maybe they just... Maybe in the book it has a more satisfying resolution and explanation for itself.
Right.
And in the movie they just were like, well, we should throw this in there because it's from the book. But we only have, like, 20 minutes, so just throw it in there.
One of the interesting things about making a movie, and I try not to criticize things that I can't do. I couldn't make a movie. But... it seems from the outside looking in like some of this stuff should be easy, right? So like you're setting up a scene where you're telling us as the audience that it's really important that they go to this planet. Why? Because they need to repair the ship. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's easy. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So then as an audience, you're expecting a couple of scenes to happen, the outcome of which should be some resolution of the issue of repairing the ship.
Yeah.
So how did they just forget?
Yeah. Well, because what you're talking about, see, movies are hard to make, but they're hard to make as a conglomeration of elements like acting and set pieces and costumes and lighting and all these things. But what you're just talking about is basic script writing.
Right.
And like basic script writing is hard. Like I wouldn't give a script to someone who can't write at all, but the level of flaws that you're talking about are overcomable by most intelligent, like most decent writers.
Right.
Even basically decent writers can avoid the pitfalls you're talking about.
Why didn't they just... I mean, H.G. Wells is a good writer. I've never read The Shape of Things to Come, but I know he's got an excellent reputation as one of the best American sci-fi writers.
That's right.
Wouldn't you just film the book?
I don't know.
Why would you make this movie?
Oh.
And it's so weird because some of the technical skills on display are not bad. Like some of the costuming, the cinematography.
Well, that's why I said that actually technically I thought it was better. You said it was around the Space Mutiny level of quality. I think it's actually better. I started counting all the different set pieces and I was like, there's a lot of scenery to chew. Like they go through a lot of different things. There's like ships and star bases and planets, and you know, she climbs a tower at one point for no reason and then comes back down. I almost thought the best part of it was just the visual variety of things to look at, and which was matched by nothing else. Like there was nothing to do with any of that.
And do you figure that's just enough to carry a movie in the 70s, and maybe that's why they didn't bother with much of a plot? It's just like, look at all these cool robots.
No, I mean, I'm sure this was probably reviewed badly even in its own time. I doubt seriously that any critics thought this was a good adaptation of H.G. Wells.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you would have heard of it. Like, have you ever heard of this movie?
No.
Of course not.
I never heard of the book either. I mean, it's, you know, he's most known for War of the Worlds. I don't know. The Shape of Things to Come, I don't know what that is. I'm kind of tempted to go and at least check it out now.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be interesting to read the book just to see. There, I just don't think... what I'm left with overall is that there was a jagged variety of how much energy was put into it. Like, I feel like a lot of energy was put into the set pieces and the costuming. And obviously Jack Palance was a decent actor, so they, you know, they invested in that to have a good bad guy. But then script writing... lazy as crap, right? Acting for everybody else, super lazy. The design of the robots, just like, come on, man, right? Like, you can do better than that. I've seen better than that in like early Doctor Who episodes. And I mean, like, they had no budget. That was like a British PBS-y kind of,
right?
I mean, back in the 70s, right? They had like $50 right. a show, right?
Right.
So, I mean, like, if they can't even rise to the level of like, you know, the villains in Doctor Who, like, then there's clearly just a disconnect between how much energy was put into different elements of this film.
So I guess one interesting thing to talk about would be the Mystery Science Theater-ness, because we talked about the movie a lot, but
yeah,
you know,
that's a tricky one, because I really like, so this is one of those rare, they only made like four or five with Emily,
right?
And it was only in the last season, and Emily is the live, she's her, that cast, like that version of Tom Servo and Crow, I believe, are the live cast, the ones that they took on the road.
Right.
Sometimes Joel would come with them and he would be like in the show too, but it was like Emily and that version of Crow and those actors would be the people that would do the road show. And I think we actually saw them do that live in San Francisco at one point, like a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And so I remember really liking the live show, and I remember thinking it felt really cohesive and it came together really nicely and it felt right. And I almost kind of wonder if, like, sometimes you see theater actors and then you see them on a TV show and you're like, this is not as good.
Right.
Like, I almost wonder if that crew is more optimized for, like, the live show, and if watching them on screen is just not as captivating as, like, Joel and Mike and,
right,
you know, the other guy, Jonah, and all that. Because I like Emily. I think she's charming. And I think I like her deadpan, and I think she's sort of like a good, she's like a female Joel in some ways. She's kind of relaxed. Like, it feels very natural. I'm not super crazy about the woman that plays Crow. I don't have a problem with a female Crow. I just think she's trying too hard and she's got a like a really weird like affectation. Like,
right.
I almost wonder if it'd be more interesting just to hear her be a normal. Cause like when Bill Corbett played Crow, and even when Trace played Crow in the later episodes, it was really just their own voice.
Right.
They just kind of were like, I'm Crow. So I almost kind of felt like the woman's trying to impersonate them, like,
right,
those other crows.
Right.
And I'm like, just be you, you know, cause you seem like a pretty funny actress, but you're being nasally and weird. So like, it's very middling to see them on screen compared to seeing them live, which might've brought down my score of this, because I remember I was chuckling a lot and I was thinking, these are pretty good jokes. Like, they're doing pretty good work with this really boring movie. But the movie's really boring and I'm not quite buying the delivery, which is like bringing down the score for me.
I think I liked it more than that. I remember I laughed a lot. So I would divide it into the skits and then the in-movie riffing. And I think the in-movie riffing was about as good as I could possibly hope for. There were a lot, yeah, of moments when I laughed out loud.
Yeah.
I think it's just not a very good movie to choose, and I'd be interested in exploring why that is. On the other hand, the skits are terrible, almost universally.
Yeah.
And not in a interesting way. And I was thinking about it during the movie. I was like, so this is one of the rare movies that I've never seen. I've seen almost every episode of Mystery Science Theater, but because this is season 13, I've just never seen this one. So I was coming to it completely fresh. And there's something, I think what I decided is that they're too earnest. And what I mean by that is, it's almost like when someone is a fan of the show, they're almost acting like fans of the show.
Yeah. It's like watching a, there used to be like dudes on YouTube that would like make their own Mystery Science Theater.
Right.
Or they would call it something a little different.
Right.
And you got this feeling that you're like, it was like fan fiction. Like,
right.
I'm watching somebody play, you know, like amateur theater hour version of like a TV show I like.
Yeah. There's a weird way in which both Joel and especially Mike, we were talking last time about how Mike is such a professional and they're, yeah, all professional comedians.
Yeah.
These folks feel like, I mean, obviously they are professionals and I get that, but they feel like fans.
Yeah.
And I think the distinction is that both Joel and Mike knew that they were just doing a stupid puppet show. And in a weird way, that gave them a relaxed feeling.
Yeah.
That is missing here. It just feels a little too earnest. Having said all that, I think they were very funny. Like, yeah. I there's definitely worse, and I think they're really funny. I think they're mostly let down by this just being a super terrible movie. And well, not terrible in an interesting way. It's terrible in a, just a, like, God, when will it end?
Yeah, we have to figure out by the end of this podcast, I think there's a lingering question that's going to be an ongoing thing of, like, what is it that actually really makes a Mystery Science Theater movie a good movie for them to watch?
Right.
There is a secret sauce, and I think it's more complicated than something you can sum up in 10 seconds.
Right.
You know? Like, there's ingredients to it.
Yeah, and it is especially interesting to watch this one because, again, not to obsess on Space Mutiny, but it's hard not to compare this one to Space Mutiny.
Well, it's so similar.
They're basically the same movie.
Yeah, it's so similar.
And Space Mutiny is just great. I mean, yeah. It's one of the greatest riffs, other than the skits, the in-movie riffing is fantastic. And this one, I mean, I can't really blame Emily and the crew for this. It's just not a good movie to riff. And I, to your point, I'm not sure exactly what the difference is, except that I know it has something to do with the writing. I would never have said in a million years that Space Mutiny is a well-written movie, but watching this one makes me appreciate Space Mutiny. Because you said at one point during the movie, you were like, this far into the movie, I should be able to explain the plot. And then you basically rattled off the plot of Space Mutiny.
Yeah, right.
Which is not a good plot, but it at least has some kind of through line of something that makes sense.
Yeah.
This movie just felt like it was meandering all over the place. And I said the same thing during Jack Frost, and that's because it was true. But I think the difference is that Jack Frost, first of all, I went into it with very low expectations. So we talked about how it exceeded expectations. This one felt like it should be a good movie, and then it's just really disappointing because it's not.
Yeah.
It's just not.
I didn't have high expectations at the very beginning, but once I saw that it was in color and it was kind of 70s-ish,
right.
There was a lot of wacky robots and crazy set pieces and explosions, I was like, okay, this is going to be Space Mutiny level entertaining. Like, I'm in for a fun ride.
Right.
It's going to be bad, but it's going to be that kind of good bad
right.
that makes you enjoy it as
right.
you go. As you're thinking, this is a stupid movie, you're also smiling and you're alive. And I mean, I was falling asleep during this. I really that whole middle section on the planet, like, oh man, I was falling asleep.
Yeah, I remember we paused it almost exactly an hour in and there were still 37 minutes.
I couldn't believe it. I thought we'd watched the whole thing. I thought they were just going to die on that planet, you know? And I was so deeply insulted when they just left. Like, when all of that came to nothing, you know?
Right.
And it's funny too, because you could argue that in Space Mutiny, that's the same thing with the Valerians, the Valerian women that come to the ship, and then, like, there's a bunch of scenes with them and they talk to the captain and it seems like there's something there, and then nothing happens with them, and then we're done with them.
Right.
But I'm just way less bothered by that because they were funny looking, and, you know, they had the whole weird hypnotism thing where they were like kind of changing the minds of some of the men on the ship, and none of it made any sense or came to anything, but it was just like fun to watch on a basic level.
Well, also, we'd have to go back and check. I mean, someday I guess it'll come up randomly and we'll watch it, but I don't remember the Valerians being on screen for anywhere near as long as that scene on the planet in this movie.
That's true. Yeah, the planet went on for a long ass time.
There's a joke they make in the movie where some random scene happens. Oh, it's the one with the psychedelic colors. And then I think Emily says when it's over, they're like, well, that ate up 2 minutes of screen time.
Yeah.
It's like, why did we do that?
Yeah.
What is any of this?
So I guess it's just probably padding. Like, I mean, that's the most likely explanation, is that they're just padding the film. They didn't have much movie and they just needed to draw it out.
Pacing is so important to the movie. Yeah. Okay, so I guess we should give it a rating. I mean, I think we know it's not going to be good, but I'm going to mentally just think of a number. Okay, I got it. I got my number. Do you want, should I go first or do you want to go first?
Yeah, no, I have a number two. You can go first.
Okay, I'm going to give it a 4.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I actually think this is going to be one of the worst ones we watch. I can't think off the top of my head, other than maybe the early seasons like K2 May,
yeah,
where they just didn't know what they were doing. This one is boring.
Mm-hmm.
It's just boring. What would you give it?
I'm gonna go 5 just because I feel very similar to you. But again, I think Emily is charming, and I think the jokes were well written. Maybe not the best delivery, maybe not the best cast, but like, I think I just give them a lot of points for the earnest energy they threw into making this the best it could be. But yes, I agree. In terms of the film itself, one of the worst ones. And I'm sure if this was like, if this had been riffed by like early Joel, it would have been like a 2 or 3.
Oh God. Yeah.
It would have been at the very bottom.
Oh yeah.
So I'm only bumping it up in credit and service to the sharp writing of this later cast, the earnestness, the charm, the, you know, not all the skits, but like a couple of, like, I like the last one.
The last skit was good.
Crow being Chromos or whatever.
That was funny.
That was pretty good. Like, yeah. I got to bump it to a 5 just for those moments.
Yeah. I'm not trying to dump on Emily. I think Emily's really great. I'd like to see Emily do a more riffable movie. I was thinking about how we were talking last time about, I was saying that I don't like it when they do modern movies. And obviously this is not a modern movie, but it occurs to me that this actually would have been funnier if the movie was worse.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Because some of the actors in, like, Space Mutiny are insultingly, like, wacky bad.
Right.
Like, the main guy, Buff McLarge Huge, and the woman that's playing a 20-year-old, but she's clearly, like, 50, and Captain Santa Claus. I mean, they're, like, colorfully bad.
Right.
They're, like, interestingly, ridiculously dumb.
Yeah.
And nothing in this movie, except maybe the robots. The robots were dumb. But, like, all the people were just kind of... just ploddingly, middlingly normal, you know?
I guess the lesson is, if you're going to be bad, be memorable.
Go all the way. Yeah. Go. Just go deep on the dumb, you know?
Yeah.
This is why I think most of the movies that are going to get like 8s and 9s and 10s from me are going to have really wacky, something really wacky is going to be going on. Like, yeah. Jack Frost was like wacky as fuck. It was just, every character was so weird looking and so like, I mean, just on a kind of an ADHD level, you can't look away kind of thing. This one, I was hard not to look away.
Yeah.
It was like, I wanted so badly not to watch this anymore.
Right.
So yeah, 5 for me.
I guess just, I would hate to give the impression that we're dumping on Emily. What were some of your favorite riffs? Do you remember any?
Yeah, I don't know. It wasn't like all that memorable. I think every time they kind of commented on the fact that the film was, had achieved another couple minutes, or, you know, just like any of those kind of psychedelic scenes where it was just like weird colors and stuff. And they would, you know, talk about getting high and like that whole sequence where all of them were like lying in their chairs.
You liked the joke about, what would the Enterprise be if it was close, but
in
the USS Compromise.
That was great. Yeah, that was great.
And they made a joke. I remember at one point they were like, it sounds like the Renfest is in full swing.
Yeah. Because
the music was wildly inappropriate.
Oh, the music cues were all at the wrong time.
Just so bad.
Yeah, it would just be really quiet for like 5 minutes and then suddenly like booming orchestrals, you know, soaring. And I'm like, nothing's happening. They're just walking around, you know, like.
Yeah.
This is not the appropriate time. Like when they lift off from the planet, I remember there's like soaring strings. And I'm like, you have not earned this. Like nothing on this planet was worth anything. Nothing happened. You've done nothing. You didn't even rescue the kids. You just left them.
Makes me think of that joke from This Island Earth when they're like the normal view.
normal view. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, poor Emily. I wonder how many other actual episodes are Emily.
There's like 4 or 5.
Are they all from season 13?
So season 13 is the one where, yeah, she wasn't in any other previous seasons. And then in season 13, what they did is they had Emily and they had Jonah and they had Joel back and they just rotated like around. So every episode they would just pick a new host.
Right.
And each of them had their own versions of Crow and Tom Servo. The actors were actually a different suite of three people.
Right.
So you get a very different flavor. It's a very kamikaze. It's the most kind of differentiable season from episode to episode. There probably is going to be a lot of lows and a lot of highs. It's going to swing up and down.
Well, I guess it's another testament to our system of choosing completely at random, because again, I would never have picked this one.
No. Yeah, no, this is forgettable for sure.
We're going deep into the catalog, but I'm really looking forward to doing more Emily. I'd like to see her do a better movie. And I don't mean a better movie, you know what I mean? I mean a more riffable movie.
It's statistically going to be a while, probably. We're going to get because we've got a lot of Joel and Mike to get through.
I mean, I know.
Just like they had, you know.
So many.
Aren't there like 200 episodes of just the original collected series before they rebooted it?
Pretty much.
So, I mean, we got a lot.
Not to mention that Cinematic Titanic and the others are all Joel and Mike.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so anyway, I guess we'll call it there.
So that's like a 4.5.
Yeah, 4.5. H.G. Wells. Yeah. H.G. Wells deserved better.
Yeah.
Okay, well, until next time.
Until next time.
Q, know it.
Cargo ships are fully loaded. They will accompany me on my mission of peace.
Hi, this is Rob, your Uber driver. I'm outside.
Osmond has arrived.
Did it bring me a present?
X marks the plot.